do this.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 53. No. Wrong, Gina, wrong.
52. 52. It's the holidays, y'all. Come on.
It's episode number 52. who are we featuring on this episode, Gina?
David Stupenis.
David Stupenis, that's right. Who is...
I always sound surprised when I say somebody's name.
Yes, you do. But David has been an industry veteran for a very long time, almost 20 years. I have known David for probably 14 years or more. But I've never met him until this time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we've known each other online for a long time. We've always chatted. We've chatted forever. And this is the first time I actually met him. And so he came for the podcast. We talk a lot about his experience in the industry, about what he's done. He's done a lot of work on motion capture for years and years. He's, you know, worked, pioneered some of that work, including work that he's done on Polar Express and Avatar. And a lot of other stuff. But he also talks about his opinion about labor laws and the visual effects industry and things of that nature. So it's a good guy. It was really great to hang out with David. Hopefully you guys will enjoy the podcast. We have a couple of announcements, Gina. What happened this week? It was a big one.
It was a big week, yeah. V-Ray 3.3 for 3DS Max. Oh. The service pack came out, and I hate to call it a service pack because it's huge.
It's a huge thing. So huge that, in fact, in the next couple of podcasts, we actually did a podcast just dedicated to it because there is so much that is happening that we needed to just sort of put it out there. So you guys will get to get the lowdown on all the new features that are available in Service Pack 3. So look forward to that one. And besides that, we're trying to, at some point, calm down a little bit before the new year. So we're going to try to take a little bit of a break now.
Yes. We had a lot going on this year.
Yeah, a lot of stuff going on. In fact, the next podcast you guys hear will be about all the stuff that has happened in 2015 and what we're hoping to do in 2016 as well. All right, guys. Hope you enjoy it.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Hello. I just want to add one more note about the podcast before we go on. In episode 51 with Doug Robel, we talked about Eric Veitch in the podcast. I mispronounced his name as Eric Veitch. It is, in fact, Eric Veitch. I also mentioned the fact that I didn't think he worked in computer graphics at all and that all of his research related to important sampling went into a lot of work that's done at Google. In fact, he did work in computer graphics, and his thesis was based entirely on computer graphics, and he ended up working at Pixar for a number of years as well. So that is an important part of the fact and was brought up to us by one of our faithful listeners, Carl, and I really appreciate the fact that he called us out on that and made sure that we would get that correction. So just acknowledging that, and I hope you guys still enjoy everything that's going on in the podcast. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
Like you said, this isn't your first rodeo, right?
Yeah, no.
You've been on a few podcasts. You've done a few podcasts. You listen to a few podcasts. You're kind of like a podcast geek just like me, aren't you?
Yeah. Way back in the day.
Yeah.
I listened to Twit when it was still good. I mean.
Okay. In fact, I remember when I was getting into, like, my wife was getting into podcasts, and she was telling me about some of the stuff, including Nerdist, which is what I got into a lot as well. But I was like, okay, I'm going to listen to some more podcasts. And I went on to 3D Pro, which is where you and I talk a lot.
Yeah.
I'll talk on 3D Pro a great deal. We should also note this is the first time we actually with
face
each other
face, yeah.
face to face. And we've known each other for probably 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny. This is the first time we've actually face to face. Yeah. Steven is also in the room. He's in the background. We don't have a microphone for him. He's actually trying to code. This is going to be hilarious.
Not only what's really odd is that this is the first time we're meeting face-to-face, even though all three of us have worked in the same facility at the same time.
That's true. No, yes.
Because you were at Sony when I was on Polar Express, and you were at Sony when I was on Open Season.
That's right. Yeah.
Because you were on Spider-Man 2, and you were on Ghost Rider.
Yep. With Kevin Mack.
Thank God we're not making superhero movies anymore.
No. What a fad. Yeah, that superhero movies, it's like the internet. It's just a fad.
I've worked on 5 Marvel movies.
Really?
Yeah.
Just Marvel. Right.
And a DC. I was on Man of Steel.
Okay. Oh, so that's okay. All right.
I got a VES nomination for that.
Hmm. For what part of it?
For best camera.
Best camera.
Yeah, and layout and stuff, and cinematography. Best cinematography.
Well, let's explain that a little bit. And
we were up against Gravity, so we were really.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
It's nice to be nominated.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to be nominated, but you know what? If you're saying a loss to Gravity, and we're like, well, okay, that
makes. Yeah.
It's nice to yeah. So if you're gonna lose to something, it's Gravity would be a good one.
Oh,
to
God,
lose
yeah.
to. So let's talk a little bit about your background, so people know where you come from and what you've been involved with for a long time.
Yeah. I'm a 20-year veteran of the industry.
Yep.
Came out of. SCAD and did some TV work and doing like episodic television of like kid show type thing. And mm-hmm. Then that wrapped up right about the same time. That was in Northern California. I was like, oh, I'm going to finish this and then I'm going to get hired at ILM because they're down the street and that's the way things work. And no.
Right.
Also this little movie called Titanic finished.
Yeah.
Right at the same time.
Yep.
And kind of released tons of people into the industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there was some layoffs after Titanic.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like I had this little crappy TV show, and they had Titanic on their reel. So I wound up doing corporate communication stuff for a few years, and then I ran into somebody playing cards that worked at ILM, and he invited me to join their group of playing cards, and wound up parlaying that into working at a company called Factor 5, which is a video game company.
Right.
That we did like Rogue Squadron 2 and 3 with LucasArts. And wound up doing, at Nintendo's insistence, we kind of went from, I was an animator. I was head of animation for the company.
Okay.
And they wanted us to use motion capture. And so I had no idea about motion capture. So I, back then, there was this email list called CG Char, which is all about CG character animation.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a guy on there named Andre Bustinobi.
Okay.
Who had headed up mocap for Titanic. And so I called him and we talked for about 2 hours about how to work with mocap. And he was like, the technology is there, it's just about the tools. And so I went to my boss and said, it's the technology's there. It's about the tools.
He just repeated the line.
Yeah, and my boss is like, great, go write the tools. I'm like, I don't know how to write. I'm an animator.
Right.
So he's like, yeah, well, you have like 8 or 9 months. So I went off and I taught myself Mel.
Okay.
And wrote all of our tools for mocap, and I worked with House Moves to do our mocap. Uh-huh. And I was talking with a couple of my friends, and they're like, oh, you should write an article about this. So I wrote an article for Game Developer Magazine about scripting for artists.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned into like there's that article, and then that turned into a GDC presentation, and that turned into a book.
Okay.
On Mel scripting for like targeted towards artists.
Okay.
Animators, you know, which is still my philosophy today. Like if you're gonna write a hardcore plugin, write in plugin, like write C++. Mm. But people who write Python scripts that can only be deciphered by someone with a CS degree is missing the point of a script. Like you want somebody who has a passing knowledge of Python,
right,
to be able to like read it and change it and use it. So I always like oversimplify all of my scripts, even to this day. You know, it's like, oh, it's still
because you feel you want to make it accessible to people that may not necessarily be
exactly.
programmers, right?
You know, it's an interpretive language, so it's like, yeah, you can optimize it, and it's gonna take 0.5 seconds versus 1.4 seconds, and that's not enough time savings to make it indecipherable.
Sure.
At least in my opinion. So that whole thing kind of garnered the attention of ImageWorks. Andre, Albert Hastings and Alberto Menache brought me down, wound up coming down to work on Polar Express and then Open Season. And then I left there.
So what were you doing on Polar Express?
Polar Express, I was one of the lead motion capture integrators.
Okay.
Which is where we...
Which at that time was like kind of like, that was like the biggest motion capture movie around.
Oh, by far. I mean, that was insane.
Like, they were trying to revolutionize the movie industry by doing that. And so being involved in motion capture on Polar Express is like ground zero, right?
Yeah. That was big. And coming from an animation background, you know, there used to be this whole like animators hate mocap, and I'm so glad that's changed.
Right.
But I got along really well with the animators.
Well, they should compliment each other.
They do. There should be no animosity between the two groups of people. There should be no animosity between the two techniques. They can coexist perfectly well together.
Yep.
So I got along really well with the animators and, you know, wrote some cool, like, they would be like, oh, we need a way of redistributing the mocap across from, like, because the mocap get delivered on the spine with three joints, and the actual driving skeleton had, like, seven.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, oh, we need a way of redistributing it. And I was like, oh, and I would go and write some mel code. I'm like, here you go. And it was, like, a whole thing with a UI, and the animator's like, if we had asked tech for this, it would take, like, a month.
Right.
And I was like, oh, well, here in... It works.
Right.
And so that kind of, I got moved out of the mocap. I was actually supposed to be working on mocap for a movie called Monster House.
Yeah.
But what happened is my body decided to try to kill me at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And I wound up
being, how did that happen?
I lost 180 pounds in about 12 months.
Wow.
That was the first time that I did that.
Okay.
And unbeknownst to me, if you do that, your gallbladder tries to kill you.
Oh.
So it takes about 2 years or so, but it does try to kill you. And so my gallbladder almost exploded on me in the middle of the night, and I was in the hospital. And then I was in the hospital in the ICU for a week. Mm-hmm. And then, and this is 2004, and I was just desperate to not die because the Red Sox were in the playoffs against the Yankees. And I was like, I am not going to die before the Red Sox win the pennant. Like this, right. That was my guiding thing. And my nurse was a Yankees fan, which was really pissing me off.
Right.
Because
you're a New Englander, right?
I'm a New Englander, yeah. And I guess technically now an Englander.
Yeah.
But the so, you know, movies stop for no one.
Yep.
So I got back to Sony, and Monster House had moved on without me. Like, I'd taken, like, 3 weeks off or 4 weeks off, I think, to, you know, not die. And so I wound up working in the pipeline department for a while, kind of generically, and then started to work on Open Season.
Mm-hmm.
And was in the tech animation pipeline group of that. Finished that off, and then left Sony, and wound up going on to, after a few months off, working on Avatar.
So after you left Sony, you went to work on Avatar, right?
Yeah, at the time it was called Project 880.
Yeah, and we should. Avatar had been in production, either pre-production, probably pre-production for years,
yeah.
Almost 10 years.
Yeah.
So Avatar had been in some way, shape, or form. I mean, one of the reasons you don't James Cameron hasn't released a big movie in a while, you know, between Titanic and Avatar was because Avatar took that long.
Well,
one of the reasons.
Yeah, I mean, he did make two documentaries.
You made documentaries. That's fine.
And,
yeah.
And you know, Jim is this amazing guy who, he's a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's transitioned from being a filmmaker who goes off on adventures. He's now an adventurer who sometimes makes movies.
Yeah.
But
he also has, he's embraced his adventures through technology.
Oh, God, yes.
So technology to him is like a...
It's a huge thing. It's a huge thing. So, you know, when I joined the crew at PA-80 or Project A-80, and there was, I think, like 10 of us.
Uh-huh.
And it was the most Skunkworks type thing you can possibly imagine.
Yeah, because it's not really a studio, right? I mean, you're just kind of like, let's make it from scratch kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, you know... There are some brilliant, brilliant people working on the show. You know, Glenn Derry, who did all the hardware, who's one of the most brilliant people on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Dan Fowler was on there too, right?
Yeah, Dan Fowler was underneath me.
I know Dan because I worked with Dan Fowler at Digital Domain.
Yeah,
before.
Dan is awesome.
Yeah, he was a funny guy.
Yeah.
And Dan, if you're listening to this, we should talk and get on the podcast. Yeah.
There's a scene that was cut from the movie that involved a big drumming sequence.
Uh-huh.
And Dan was very critical
of the
drumming. Dan's a drummer.
Yeah.
I think people can interpret that. So that was 3 years of Avatar.
So 3 years working on motion capture for Avatar.
Yeah.
Which obviously was a big part of Avatar as well, right?
And yeah.
You would say that was a lot of the animation was driven through the motion capture system, virtual cameras, et cetera.
Yeah, that was the big thing the motion capture was not cut and dry because it was, Giant Studios did a fantastic job with the data. We were running 22 characters live in the volume, which, I'm talking about live in terms of like, oh, you can see them running around on the screen live in Motion Builder. Their system is so insane. We had characters that were rolling around on the ground.
Interacting with each other.
Interacting with each other and props. And Giant's like, yeah, we can handle that. No problem. Like, it was insane.
Yeah, I don't know how to keep track of all that stuff.
God, their technology is so... Vaughn, who's the guy who kind of like wrote all their technology, is brilliant on a level that is incomprehensible. And then Dan Neufeld, Danimal, was on the Lightstorm side with the plug-in and just so many brilliant people on that movie. It's not even funny.
I should explain to people why that because we have a variety of people that listen to this podcast, why that's an incredible thing. The way that motion capture works really is that you have people in a suit. Everyone's seen this before. They're in a suit and they've got tracking markers on them, usually little balls that are highly reflective that a infrared camera picks up. So when an infrared camera sees it, all they see is that ball and they can track it unbelievably accurately, right?
Yeah.
They can track where it's moving unbelievably
accurately. And it's just triangulation from there.
It's just triangulation. It's like this camera sees it there, this camera, and then they triangulate the area and they say, okay, this ball is here in space. And then it constructs the joint system of this person based on that information and drives the motion capture. What's incredible is if you have two people that are fighting each other or rolling around the ground.
You have two people that each have 72 little ping pong balls that are reflective,
right?
And they're grappling around, rolling on the floor, and
you got to figure out which ball goes to which person and which joint goes. Like, how the hell did that happen?
On a floor that's the size of a 70 feet by, I think 38 feet or something like that. It was the largest volume at the time. Actually, the biggest problems we used to have were not like...
How many cameras?
It was like 270. It was insane.
Wow.
Yeah.
And each camera cost like 25 grand.
Yeah. Yeah. it used to... we also had these reference cameras, which at the time were like... they were the Sony P900, I think is what it was. And each of those is like $250,000. And we had 10 of those in the volume with the reference guys shooting that.
Damn.
And it's like, that was a big deal because it shot 24p at 1080. I'm like, oh, I have my phone that does that now.
Yeah, well. I think your phone does 120 FPS.
Yeah, 240 if I drop it down to 720.
Yeah.
But the really... hilarious thing is like you'd have all these markers, two characters rolling around and be hold together, but you have one person walk into the volume with New Balance shoes and it was screwed up, or
because the reflectors on the shoes.
Retro reflective, or we had one person, I won't name who it is, I'll tell you after because I don't want to embarrass him, but he is bald, and so when he would walk in, all the little Klieg lights would reflect off of his bald head,
right?
And the cameras would pick that up as a retro reflective pickup.
It's like the problem with people wearing glasses.
Yep. No, yeah. Jim Cameron's, when we were doing the virtual camera,
did he have to powder his head?
No. We would make him wear. We would make that particular person wear a hat.
Okay.
But Jim had what's it called? Amiga.
The big watch.
Sea King or something like that.
Right. One of the diving watches.
And so that would the crystal of that would catch the light occasionally and just send the camera all freaky deaky.
Yeah.
And he'd be like, what's going on? I'm like, your watch, Tim, your watch. So, a lot of the technologies were pre-existing before Avatar.
Yeah.
They were working with virtual cameras a little bit at Sony on back in Polar Express and definitely on SurfSup and stuff. And Rob Legato had worked a lot at DD with kind of the formation, especially on the preamble, like the test that was done for Avatar. But, like over those 3 years, yeah. we completely developed like the workflows for virtual production and, you know, that kind of thing. And everyone was convinced that this is the future. I mean, we had so many just amazing people come through on tours. You know, it's like I'd be sitting there and look up and it's like, oh, David Fincher's here. Yeah. Or, you know, yep. Robert Rodriguez and right. Quentin Tarantino. And this is like J.J. Abrams. And this is like, holy.
Everyone wanted to see what was going on.
Yeah. And we also got loaned out to Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson to do the prototype of Tintin.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So I worked on that while I was there as well.
Yeah. So you and I were talking before. I mean, I know things got really busy for you, and we can talk about what happened after Avatar and all that stuff. But I had a big interest in what you were doing because I had never really been – I came from the lighting side of things, right? So by the time I get it, everything's nice and smooth and finished by the animators and the motion capture stuff. But I'm kind of smiling while I'm saying that. But at the same time, I'd never really been involved in that process. I didn't really know much about it, but I started to get involved with it when I started working with Kevin on Construct. And we're starting to look at rendering happening in real time. And you contacted me, and it's like, so we never actually had a chance to sort of push that, because I know you got too busy, but you were enthusiastic. It's like, do you see? Yeah. So tell me your thoughts about.
Well, so, you know, during the making of Avatar, like Jim had this, what we call the virtual camera, which is pretty much just
sticks with a monitor.
Yeah, it's an apparatus that has a monitor attached to it, and it behaves like a real camera, and you can do. How you use that is huge, because it's like a lot of times you would shoot at half speed so that your camera motion would be smoother.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's always a lag in the system, it's about a 4-millisecond lag between when you make a movement with the camera and when it gets down the cable into the processor. You
Interesting.
Know. So you have to, you know, like having a running, playing back things at half speed, you can make your camera moves quicker, but you can also do things like scale so that every step you take is actually 10 feet in the world, or is only, if you step 10 feet, it's only 3 inches. So that if you're doing like a close-up on a person,
right.
you can be wrapping around. So
you miniaturize yourself.
Yeah, it's almost like shooting a close-up on Mount Rushmore.
Right.
Or making the entire world a miniature so that as you're walking, you're doing a massive helicopter shot.
Right.
How you like, or taking the entire volume and making it vertical so that as you're walking forward across the ground, you're actually diving down a cliff face.
Right.
Stuff like that. You know, but we would work with that, but you would, I remember one day we were shooting this scene where, Jake Sully he's waking up in his avatar body for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes running out into the field because he has legs.
Right.
Right. And we're running everything in the OpenGL of Motion Builder, and I used to try to push it as hard as I could. I'd be throwing in particle effects. I'd be throwing in lighting stuff. And because the original thing was, we're just going to do this all gray shaded, no lighting.
Right.
We're just going to frame it up, and that's fine. And then it started to get textures, and then it started to get lighting, and then it started to get effects, and it started to become very refined. Like, when Autodesk saw what we were doing, they were kind of blown away by how
like you guys are trying to do that much with this.
Yeah, pushing it to the max. And that was the other thing about running at half speed, is when all the system can do is 16 frames a second or 12 frames a second,
right,
that's the only way you can actually get feedback. Mm-hmm. But I just threw in a little completely transparent plane,
mm-hmm.
and had a shadow on it from the spotlight, and that was the first time we had shadows cast from anything.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim was like, oh, hey. And he pointed it down, the camera down at the ground. Mm. And so you'd see the shadow come in, and then he tilted up onto Jake's face. And it completely changed what the shot was going to be.
Because he had feedback.
Because he had feedback in terms of not just the shape of something, but its effect on the world.
And the lighting. Yeah.
So, you know, it's amazing how, you know, throwing a rim light on something, how you frame it up, throwing in focus, doing a focus pull, how that changes what you're framing, how you're framing.
And then a DP can be on the...
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and so when I saw what was being done with Construct, I was like, this is what I want. Because I've made the transition over the course of my career. It's like, okay, I'm doing animation and mocap and then into pipeline and back into mocap, and being a stage operator was kind of everything on top of it. I was like, I'd write code, I'd write, do effects, I'd do, you know, animation and all that kind of stuff. And then going off to Double Negative and doing lighting. And then I was like, I, you know, the lighter's jobs can be made very easy or very hard based on layout.
Yes.
Okay.
If the layout's good, it's like your job is done in 5 minutes if you're a good lighter.
Pipe. So I became very, very big advocate of like the pipeline initiation step because what's happened over the years, like when I got involved in the industry, I remember when match movers were like the gods. They're like your best, most technical animators got made match movers because they had to animate the camera frame by frame by hand.
Right.
Right. And now we're at the point where people are like, oh, I'm going to throw it into a 3D Buzu. Equalizer and or Buzu and like hit a button and 95% of the time I'm going to get a track.
Right.
And the other 5% of the time I give it to my supervisor.
Right.
You know, because I don't know what to do. And so there's been this view of just match move and layout being a dumping ground for entry level people.
Yeah.
And I'm a big advocate of like, no, you have to take that seriously because if the match move is wrong, if the layout is wrong, everything else is going to be wrong. Right. Everything else is going to be completely screwed. So I became a very big advocate of like working in layout type area. So I'm big on trying to bring real filmmaking terminology and tools and everything right into layout because my dream is that, and I realize a lot of people might not like this, I don't think there should be a supervising lighter on a effects movie.
I don't disagree with you.
I think the DP of the movie should come in and be making comments about where the lighting is.
Yeah, because then he's the person that she's the person that decided how the movie should be lit anyway.
Yeah, because one of the problems you have is that now.
Let's look at it. Let's look at a camera department on set, right?
Right.
A camera department on set involves a DP who has a vision of what the lighting is supposed to be, right? And then that person has a crew of people that works with him to make that. He's got an electrician, camera people. He's got assistant camera people, you know, and dolly people and all these different people that work together to make that vision happen. There can be digital versions of those people as well.
Digital versions of the people and digital versions of what they're using. Like, I don't think you should ever grab something called a spotlight or an area light or directional light. There should be like a kit of tools where you're like, oh, I'm going to grab an RE2K.
Yeah.
And then, I hate it when, if you're talking to a lighter and you're like, yeah, just put like an RE2K in there and then double it down. Mm-hmm. Like, they should know what you're talking about.
No, I have no idea.
You know, but they're like, oh,
is that an HDR?
Yeah. It's that kind of thing. So,
but there is, okay, now, the way, listen, well, you want to talk about lighting for a little bit, that's fine. The way that lighting has happened is that basically we have gone into an image-based lighting world, okay? And I don't think there's necessarily something wrong with that because it has served us a huge amount because lighting, as we know, is coming more than just from the source. It's coming from the entire environment around you. Obviously, you've got global illumination that's happening, et cetera. And so generally speaking, that world has served us for a long time. And I did talk to a friend of mine who works for Low Lights. He actually designs lights for them. And I was talking about the idea that, you know, from the architecture side of things, people design IES lights, right? Which are designed and they are exact, correct lighting intensity that is distributed across the area of where the light is. So it's in the most accurate lighting thing. And in fact, it wasn't even designed to work in CG. It was designed to actually figure out the intensity of heat and distribution and photons when you're designing spaces. So there was no actual renderings done with IES lights. But we could still use that data to light, which was great. So I asked him, so can I get an IES light for, you know, one of your light kits? And he goes, not really. And I go, why not? He says, because the minute all of our lights are adjustable, and the minute you adjust it, you messed up the IS data. So it's really hard to mimic it.
Well, what you need to do is same thing that you do with like creating an HDRI, where you don't take every single exposure level, you take 3-7 steps or whatever, and then you interpolate between them.
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to design a system, which would be cool. And actually, Stephen here and I have been talking about creating an IES system for years, maybe something we could think about and brainstorm about. But just the idea of like, you know, creating light kits that are great, you know.
Well, because what you want to be able to do is I know you're very big on your respect VFX and talking about how people blame CGI for ruining everything.
Sure.
But I think one of the issues that comes into it, why sometimes CGI is blamed, because no one blames good CGI because you don't see it.
Right.
Right. But what happens is you have a DP on set and they're like, oh, yeah, we're going to put a CGI character there. So just point the camera at the wall and there will be a character there. And yeah, they don't know how to light it.
I'm sorry, but that's also a typical animator's point of view, because I also hear, and I'm just, and we're just going to jab at each other, which is fine. But I've seen so many lighters basically blame the CG problem on bad animation or bad motion capture as well. So I think they're both to blame.
Right. But I mean, like, we're now at the point a lot of times in VFX where we just throw away the entire plate and just will completely go with a CG background that, that people then think is the photography.
Right.
But we could, because we've had to relight it to make the character.
Yeah. And you can't, asking a DP to light a blank wall with no character is really hard.
Which is where if you can get real time on set lighting that is tied into their lighting kit.
Yeah.
Would be huge, because you can put a proxy of the character there that you're lighting and he goes, oh shit, let's just put a 2K.
Let me ask you this. When you were on set with on Avatar, right?
Yeah.
Do you guys have a dolly track?
We had a wheelchair.
Right. Why wasn't there a dolly track? Why wasn't there a crane? Why don't
there there wasn't Tintin. They did use all that on Tintin.
Okay.
But Jim would, because what we would do is,
because that's the way people light it in the real world, because in a motion capture stage, it's all handheld
right,
for some reason.
Well, what we would do is we had a whole – I wrote a series of scripts that what they would do is we got the shorthand. Jim would just be like, make that a dolly shot. And I would have a whole set of algorithms that would smooth out the mocap to make it look
right.
Like we had handheld, we had like rough handheld, so it's like Paul Greengrass up to like Steadicam,
mm-hmm.
and then onto like helicopter, you know, all that kind of stuff. So you can algorithmic, but yeah, if we wanted to do a dolly shot, you know, there's a point where Jim's leg was broken and we were just rolling his butt around on a wheelchair,
okay,
holding like his, like your student film days,
right?
But the, you know, if you can put up, you know, if you can have your spark go up there and put up a 2K Kino,
yeah,
and then your CG operator on stage can go, oh yeah, okay, and then, you know, have a complete model of the, mic, sorry, people. You have a complete model of the stage where you can, you know, within a couple of inches, place it in the exact same spot,
yeah,
get the same settings that they're dialing it up to and put it in there and have it so that you can have your, you know, your ZBrush model,
mm-hmm.
You know. Personally, I think one of the big things that is to blame for people blaming CG for looking bad these days is concept art and directors becoming attached to an image.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens,
I could see that.
You know, because it's like directors get very attached to an image.
And it's all the same characters these days, too.
Right. So what happens is you have a painting of some environment that somebody painted up in Photoshop or whatever.
Right.
And, or, you know, usually sketch up and then paint it over or whatever. And it's, they've been looking at that for 18 months. Yeah. And then they get their
They get married to that.
They get married to that. And they want to push that into a level of, no, if you were actually, regardless of whether or not you're on the film side or digital cameras or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, the amount, the dynamic range that can be captured by a camera, whatever that camera is limited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a certain stop. The, you know, a breadth, a bandwidth of stoppage,
mm-hmm.
that a camera can capture. And we're now being pushed into CG where, like, oh no, you can see all the detail in the darks, you can see all the detail in the lights, and you can see all the detail anywhere in between. And regardless of whether or not it works, it, like, technically you can do it, to people's brains, it looks wrong because they know a photograph cannot look like that.
Right.
You know, that's why it looks CG. You know, there's this moment.
Right, because they're basically imitating a painting instead of a photograph.
Exactly.
Right.
You know. Did you ever see the movie Tim's Vermeer?
Yes.
You know, where he talks about how.
We were just talking about that.
I love that movie. but he talks about where it looks like a video signal.
Right.
And that's where there's a certain way that light behaves within captured technology, whatever that technology is, that's different from reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so while that complete bandwidth of light and everything looks great for something like Toy Story,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't necessarily work well when you're trying to create completely photorealistic blending with photography.
Yeah. And, you know, so here's another thing that happens, and I think there's a balance that needs to happen as well, is that obviously there's imperfections, right? There are imperfections that happen that like you said, like there's a dynamic range that a camera can capture, and it's not necessarily the same as what you have in a painting. But what I think is interesting is that sometimes people nail that, they get the imperfections just right, and sometimes they're like, they go way too far. They put so much lens flares and crap at the screen that it's like, it's out of control.
My biggest pet peeve right now is people covering up a comp by putting dirt on the lens, and it's just like any DP that let their lens get that dirty would have been fired on the first day.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I get, okay, lens flares, whatever, those are there, those actually exist.
That's a problem with the lens. You can't fix that.
Yeah. But dirt on the lens.
Yeah, might as well put hairs in there too.
Yeah, you know, I totally get the fact that you're just like, listen, the photography isn't there.
Right.
Like that the clients provided us, but we have to use it. And we need to hide, you know, we have 4 hours to get this delivered because they just changed the shot brief this morning and the movie comes out. I have worked on movies where the client has thrown out a shot with the movie coming out in theaters in 9 days.
Right.
You know, and you have to go back to scratch and you just have to get, you know, like we don't care what 87 frames we give them, but we're giving them 87 frames the day after tomorrow because we have to, you know, and so you do whatever you can to cover up that, you know, to make yourself not embarrassed of it.
Right.
But then people see it and they go, oh, that's bad CG. It's like... Like, I know you can't qualify going, like, you don't know the back history.
Right.
But it's not – a lot of times, it's not our fault. And I think a lot of it –
Oh, I think most of the time, it's not our fault. I think there's a lot of choices that are being made that are beyond the control of the visual effects people, right? There's also an aesthetic that people have. Well, so many times we go out there and we create something that's really cool and unique and they're like, well, it doesn't look like this. And they give you a reference like, oh, if you're going to keep doing the same crap every time, it's like, of course, it's all going to look like the same crap. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of that. But I've seen so many great ideas thrown away because they don't look like a specific reference.
Yeah.
You know, just like you said before with the artwork, it doesn't look like the artwork, you know, like use your imagination, you know?
Yeah, like, yes, it doesn't look like your artwork. It looks realistic.
Yeah, yeah. So it's all right. Let's skip ahead because I want to get to London.
Oh, yes.
We have to get to
it's
London.
Easy. Take a plane. Yeah, about 10 hours.
Right, 10 hours on a plane. And so you got to – you after Avatar, you went to London. I think you went to DNEG, right?
Yeah, Double Negative, yeah.
And so I remember you being a big contributor on the VFX show for a while, and then you basically went to London, and that's when you sort of dropped off the podcast side for a while. And you got involved at DNEG. You were doing similar stuff over there, or
I was. You know, I don't want to get into any of the internal things going on, but I'd originally gone over to work on a movie called John Carter, and then there was a delay in my visa getting approved, and again, movies don't stop for no one. So I wound up going over there and working on Sorcerer's Apprentice and then Iron Man 2 as a lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, I kind of came over here to do cameras and that kind of stuff.
You were a lighter?
I was lighting, yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
So I was like, I went over to the previs department for a while, which was great, and then did some little bit of work on the Total Recall remake, and and then over into doing all the cameras and post viz for Man of Steel, and that was like my first opportunity there to really kind of I worked on like Harry Potter as doing cameras and that kind of stuff, but. On Man of Steel, it was the first time where I was like really given the authority to kind of run my department the way I wanted to. And it was great. It was a fantastic experience because I had my little crew and I said, I want everyone in the same room.
Yep.
I didn't let production assign shots to people. I was like, I will assign shots to people. And the way I actually did it is I had people pick what shot they wanted to do.
Sure.
And then it would get surrounding shots. And that way, and I rotated every time we did assignments, I rotated who got to pick first.
Okay.
So that everyone got good shots for the reel. No one felt like they're being neglected.
Yep.
You know, it was, everyone got along really well, fostered a great environment in the room. You know, it was very, it got a little bit frat boy, a little bit, because it was like.
Sure. Well, that's VFX then.
You know, we used to have dance contests on Friday afternoons, and
nice.
You know, I would buy people beer. Saturdays, if we had to come in, I would bring donuts in. I did, however, work a lot, like because I would take care of all. I find it very annoying when supervisors don't do shot work.
Okay.
I think a supervisor should be working on the box,
yep.
not just adding comments, because then you know what's breaking, what's not working, all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So I took on a full shot load myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I would work all day supervising,
mm-hmm.
and then I'd be there. I'd be there till 11 o'clock. You know, I wound up, I think, coming off that show with 46 days of toil, which means time off in lieu,
mm-hmm.
Because you don't get overtime in the UK.
Okay.
But if you work on the weekend, you get either paid for the day, a day rate, or you can take a day off in response. So finished up that, and I was actually had planned on leaving England at the end of that movie.
Okay.
But over the course of that movie, I'd actually started dating somebody and was quite in love. And so I stayed.
Okay.
Pretty much to stay with her.
Uh-huh.
Then I worked on a couple bid projects, which was really cool, and wound up working on set for Jupiter Ascending.
Yep.
And then...
independently?
No, I was there on behalf of Double Negative.
Okay.
Doing tech viz and planning and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And then I had a... I broke up with that person.
Yeah.
And was pretty determined that... I was like, okay, you have a couple different things you can do here. But I wound up coming... I worked on a Thor 2.
Mm-hmm.
And... My working experience on that was awesome because there was a sequence that had been added to the movie that they basically brought me on. They pulled me off of Jupiter Ascending and put me onto that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just complete creativity. That's all I had to do.
Nice.
I didn't have to worry about pipeline. I didn't have to worry about nothing. There's this brilliant, brilliant man at Double Negative named Rick Leary. He's a CG supervisor there. And he and I worked together on Harry Potter. He and I worked together on Man of Steel. He was CG supervising this one sequence. And so it was just like, I just had to do cameras, get it approved by the VFX supervisor, by the director and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, they were used to, we're getting 2, maybe 3 cameras out of the entire department per week.
Right.
My first week on the show, I delivered 22 cameras.
Okay.
Because I only had to worry about composition.
Right.
Right? So the VFX supervisor on that, Alex Wicca, we really wanted to work together again after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to stick around just to work on whatever that. So that wound up being Ant-Man.
Okay.
And so I got onto Ant-Man. I started on that right after Jupiter Ascending in February of 2014, doing research on how we were going to do all the set photography.
Yep.
Because, you know, normally you go on set and you shoot in HDRI, which means you either do a panorama or you shoot a chromosphere and you do 3, maybe 7 stops.
Mm-hmm.
Shooting macro HDRIs mean that you shoot a, you know, we would shoot a 15 by 12 tile with anywhere from 12 to 30 focus stops.
Focus stops.
Yes. Yeah. So you'd have to do three stops of exposure at different focus points. So if you're talking about doing like, let's say you're doing 15 focus stops and three, so that's 45 exposures for every single tile. So if you're doing a 15 by 12 tile, that's 15 times 12 times 3 times 15.
Right.
So I did the math. I was like, you're going to wear out your shutter on your 5D about every 4 shoots.
Right.
You know, I think there was like 600,000 exposures that we took on the movie.
Wow.
To create, you know, these environments, because we would have to take, you know, when you're shooting macro, you have a very narrow depth of field. So I worked on that developing that for a few months, and our motion reference technology, I guess, would be the best way of doing it. I designed these little suits that the actors had to wear.
Mm-hmm.
And so working on Ant-Man, and then Double Negative got bought by Prime Focus during this time, and I was determined to, like, I decided to leave at that point, but I don't abandon a project midstream. Sure. So I was like, I'm leaving, but I'm going to finish Ant-Man. So I finished Ant-Man. I wound up actually working 2 weeks on Mission Impossible, and then left and came back here.
Okay. So what drove that? What drove the... Because when you and I talked last, you said, I'm back in LA. I was like, oh, great. And it says, I have no job. I have nothing. So you made that decision. Obviously, you weren't tied down to the girl anymore.
Nope, I was not tied down to the girl. I had a staff position at Double Negative.
You have a Double Negative staff position.
With a
company that's not going away anytime soon.
Nope. Literally up until the day before I left, they were asking me to stay. They, you know, so I could have stayed if I want to.
Right.
But I didn't want to work for a company with the ethical reputation of Prime Focus.
Okay.
At the end of the day, my labor would be going to profit somebody who I had a ethical issue with. And I realize there are probably some people who know me who are like, wait, David has ethics.
Right.
But, you know, It's I have been often to my own detriment, a very, very vocal person about labor rights in our industry.
Yes.
And, you know, you got to put your money where your mouth is.
Yes.
And, you know, like during Ant-Man, I was very, very adamant that no one on my crew worked overtime.
Right. So explain the overtime thing.
Okay. People have a very fundamental misunderstanding of overtime. Overtime is not about you making a lot of money for working a lot of extra time. Overtime is about punishing somebody for poor planning.
Yes, of course.
You know, to prevent you from taking advantage of people's labor. Right? So it's like, in the UK, you don't have to pay overtime. Okay? And they don't think that's an issue because there's a law that says you can't work more than 45 hours a week, right?
So you can't work 45 hours, so you're not have to worry about overtime anyway.
Right. However, unlike here
in
the U.S., you can waive your right to a 45-hour work week.
So you can say, I agree that I could work over 45 hours.
Yes. And by default, that's in every single VFX contract in the U.K.
Of course.
That you waive it. Now, they can't do anything to you if you decide to go. Like, you can just go down to HR and say, here you go. And the way they not get around that, but it's an average. Like, it's not 45 hours per week. It's an average of 45 hours per week over the course of a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not paying over. They just simply do not. You get paid a day rate. So there is no qualms about asking people to work rather ridiculous hours. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's unfair. I'm a big believer that every minute worked is every minute paid.
Sure.
That doing anything else is taking advantage of.
Well, I think that there's a certain thing, right? So as an example, certain supervisors are paid a lot of money and sometimes do whatever they have to get their job done, right?
Yeah.
So if you know, like, all right, I'm a supervisor, I got to get shit done. I'm going to be paid X amount of dollars. I'm going to stay and do whatever I have to do to get that done. That's different than a supervisor going to someone and say, hey, you got to work extra hours tonight to get that done. I make that decision on my own as a supervisor. That's a different part of it.
That's a different part of it. And there's also, the thing is like in any job, I think, there's always going to be crunch mode, right?
Sure.
You know, where you need that final push. But the problem is it used to be crunch mode was, the film is delivering in 2 weeks.
Right.
Okay. Crunch mode. Now it's, and then it became like, okay, well, we got a trailer. We got crunch mode. And then, okay, now we have the movie, crunch mode, two crunch modes.
Okay.
Then it became, okay, well, we got Show West. Then we got the trailer. Then we have a friends and family screening. Then we have another friends and family screening. Yeah. Then, you know, so it's crunch mode after crunch mode after crunch mode. When a movie isn't in theaters for 9 months, there should be no reason anyone is working extra long hours anything.
I know. My wife is dealing with that right now. I'm not going to say anything more. But she's like insane amount of work that she's doing right now, and it's December. And the movie doesn't actually come out till Valentine's
yeah,
Day.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah. And it's like, at the end of the day, it's also just a movie. But the other problem with not being paid overtime is it doesn't enforce a good work ethic, right?
Sure. Because so let me explain overtime to those who are not from the U.S. and don't necessarily know what overtime is, because there are some people that are listening to me and ask to know what that is. So in the United States, well, there's laws in the United States that you can force that to happen, right? So in the United States, the laws are that if you're allowed to work 8 hours a day on, and then anything over 8 hours is considered overtime. By law, you have to make if you're less, just to make the math easy, let's say you're being paid $40 an hour, which is a fairly good rate for most places, but let's say you're $40 an hour. If you're working over 8 hours, between 8 and 12 hours, you're getting paid time and a half. So from 8 hours to 12 hours, you're getting paid $60 an hour. If you work over 12 hours, which also happens, you get paid double time. So it's an hour, it's $80 an hour. Now that continues. If you're working Saturday, all of Saturday is a time and a half. And then if
to
12 hours.
No, it's if you've worked 40 hours during your normal 5 days.
Yeah.
Your
sixth day.
Your sixth day is normal time for the first 8 hours. And then so even if you've only worked 48 hours, then you get into time and a half right after, like you get right into time and a half, and your seventh day is double time from the moment you show up.
Right.
And then you also then get double time every single day until you have two consecutive days off.
Right.
Is the way it's supposed to work.
So by the way, if you work Saturday and Sunday, if you go to work on Monday, you're getting paid double time.
You should be legally getting paid.
So there's a lot of these, and to be honest, a lot of places in the U.S. were skirting that law. A great deal, right?
Still are.
And they still are.
Not.
They're like, oh, we're going to make you quote unquote staff, and so therefore we'll pay you this.
Or a manager,
right.
They make you a manager, and therefore you don't have to be paid overtime.
Right.
And, you know, it's... I'm not going to get into all the itsy bitsies, but...
But let's just put it this way. Other production groups like camera people, anything unionized, those guys, like, you don't fuck around with those guys.
Oh, God, no.
No. Like, those guys get paid the minute that clock hits.
I have been on sets where at 12 o'clock after, like, where we're doing a big marathon session.
Right.
Where at 12 hours, the entire construction crew was replaced with a new construction crew.
Right.
You know, at 9:30 at night.
So they hire two different sets.
They had a whole different crew come in that would keep working because then they were just on their 8 hours.
Right.
Right. They started the day.
Well, that would make sense too.
Yeah.
Someone just worked 12 hours.
Yeah.
Building shit.
The thing is you there's a it's not just a matter of punishing production for poor planning or management or whatever or you making a lot of money.
Safety.
There's safety. Yeah. You know, I mean. VFX, you think of it like, oh, I'm basically an accountant because I sit on the computer and look at numbers.
No, I've seen so many. Well, we just had this discussion on 3D Pro about the guy who flipped out and what's been on the news, all over the news.
Yeah.
He flipped out and ended up in Mexico for some reason, right?
Yeah, but I mean, there have been people who've died.
Yes.
Because they have worked so late.
That they drove home.
They've driven home and it's just like driving drunk.
Yeah.
Right? But you also have a thing where... I've noticed where if you're not getting paid overtime, you think nothing of going off to the kitchen and having a coffee for an hour and a half.
Right.
Because what does it matter if I'm here till 9:30? Well, it might not matter to you, but it might as fucking matter to the compositor who's waiting for your lighting shot to get out so he can go home and see his kids.
Right.
If you can't work late unless you're approved by somebody to work late...
Yeah,
and you still need to deliver shots on a certain schedule.
Right,
you're gonna sit at your desk and you're gonna do your shots and you're gonna take a 5 minute break to go to the bathroom and get a coffee once an hour. That's completely reasonable.
Right,
but you're also not going to think my entire life is in this building.
Right,
you're gonna develop by necessity a life work balance, and that is completely healthy.
Right,
and the reason VFX is screwed, I realize there's a lot of people who, you know, see the whole VFX labor movement as like an LA centric, let's bring work back to LA. And I'm not like that at all. Like,
no, I don't think that's anything to do with it. Talent is talent, no matter what.
Talent is talent. Right. I'm anti subsidies because I think that having a thumb on a scale is just wrong.
Right.
But there are tons of insanely talented people in London.
Yeah.
And there are tons of insanely talented people in Vancouver and Wellington and Paris and Italy and South Africa, and there are people who don't want to come to the U.S. I know that will be a shock to a lot of people, but right. there are people who are perfectly happy living where they live, and they want to do VFX, and I'm like, hey, more power to you.
Unfortunately, the movies are produced by American companies, all of which are in Los Angeles. So no matter where you're working, you're still working for an American company.
Yeah.
And that's, at the end of the day, that's in Los Angeles. Trust me, because I drive by 4 or 5 of the 6 on my way from between Burbank and Culver City. I'm driving by almost every one of them.
Yeah, we're around the corner from one now. And, right. And believe it or not.
That's where, by the way, all of your tax dollars in the UK and in Vancouver, they're all going here. They're not going to save, you know, your industry or whatever. They're coming right back to Los Angeles, California.
Exactly. And this is the problem in general with unionization of people within, like, the actual people on the box.
Yeah.
You know, there's, I mean, more power to them. The guys at MPC in their compositing department just unionized.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested to see how that's going to play out.
Yeah.
But the problem with a union, in terms of that, is a union is there to settle a dispute between an employee and their employer.
And but the UK hasn't done anything wrong yet.
But their employer is the vendor. It's not the studio.
Oh, right.
Right. Those compositors are working for MPC. They're like, their paycheck eventually, you know, it goes from, you know, Warner Brothers to the production company to.
That's kind of the argument a lot of people made about unionization is like, well, you're going to unionize and go against, let's say, you know, ILM, Digital Main, MPC, DNAG, whatever. If you unionize against them, those guys are struggling to make a 2% profit. So.
Oh yeah,
that serves. You're hurting the one company that's the only one that
totally.
They're suffering almost more than you are. Totally. Which is why there's so many bankruptcies, right?
And then you also have the problem that the authority of a union stops at the borders of a country.
Yes, and not only that, that was the thing. It's like, obviously, you know, there's a lot of feelings about the industry being hurt by a bunch of other things, and the unions don't necessarily discourage tax subsidies. In fact, they encourage them because then they can actually get more people to join unions in other countries.
well, no, because like SAG, there is no SAG in UK.
Okay.
You know, there is no SAG after, I guess there's their official name. You know, there is no SAG down in New Zealand.
There's IATSE all over the place, though.
There's IATSE in Canada and there's IATSE here. Right?
Okay.
But the IATSE local, that's why it's called a local,
right.
only is valid for Vancouver, right? Okay. So there are unions that have solved this. Okay, not solved it, but like SAG-AFTRA has something called Global Rule 1.
Okay.
Which means that if you're a SAG actor and you're on set in London, you have to be treated under the conditions of the SAG collective bargaining agreement, even though you're in London.
Okay.
That's great for that person. But the advantage of SAG is that if you want Tom Hanks to be in your movie has to go union, which means that, Tom Hanks has the protection of SAG. Tom Hanks doesn't need the protection of SAG. SAG needs the protection of Tom Hanks, right?
Sure.
So, but Tom Hanks' bosom buddies certainly needed the protection of SAG.
Right.
So when you want to hire Tom Hanks and your movie goes SAG after a union, that means all the extras, all of the day players, all of your supporting people who you don't know who they are, but you're just like, that guy, I think I saw him in a Dodge commercial. Mm-hmm. Like that guy, he also is protected by your work. You have 12-hour turnaround. You're going to be paid overtime. You're going to get a meal every 6 hours. Mm-hmm. All these union protections are provided by the umbrella of the star on the movie.
Right.
You know, and same thing with camera. Like, you know, the focus puller, you know, first AC, he doesn't have the clout to get the show to go union. But when you want Roger Deakins, now we have to deal. Okay, we need Roger Deakins, which means we have to deal with the union.
So basically, like, that was the thing. If you're going to unionize, you're going to have to convince the Dennis Murins, all those guys.
This is where I think we can fix our industry.
First of all, let's before we get there, because I know where you're going to go. So you left the UK. You thought that the one, the work ethics that were going on specifically in the company you worked for, not necessarily something you wanted to foster, but you also feel that in general, the way that the work, the labor of visual effects in the UK is not up to snuff or is not quite right? Besides, obviously we know
how you work or no?
No. You obviously, I know you have a specific opinion about subsidies, which I share in a lot of what you have to say. I agree with it. But you also feel that generally the labor practices of the people that are in visual effects is been distorted too much.
I do.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, I
obviously this is not a new subject, right? Which is why NPC's comp department is trying to unionize.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite a gripe with a lot of people.
Sure.
You know, and it was also time for me to put up or shut up because my visa was running out and you can only renew your visa for 6 years until you actually have to go through the process of starting to become a citizen and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, no, I'm done. And,
okay.
You know, and I really, really miss my friends that I made in the UK, but I don't miss living in the UK.
Okay.
You know, I want to move back to.
And you lived there for what, 6 years?
6 years.
Yeah.
You know, I like to say it took me 25 years to move home to LA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love this city. Everything it has to offer. I love the weather. You know, I'm a warm weather guy.
Yeah.
Like Vancouver and London. So why can't Costa Rica offer subsidies? I'd be completely pro subsidies if like Belize would offer subsidies.
Right.
But
they tried it in New Mexico.
Yeah, not a lot of beaches there.
Yeah.
But the I want to move back here. You know, I people were like, wow, because I would say I'd rather be unemployed in LA than still employed in London.
Wow. That's a strong statement.
You know, so right now.
So okay. So you moved here, you got it. It's like, all right, I'm done. I understand it. I feel it's broken. But you feel that you have an idea that you want to introduce that you think could work.
And I've talked to Scott Squires about this, and I've talked to Steve Kaplan at IOTSI about this,
right.
And they're all like, wow, that could almost work. Which is, if you can get production side visual effects supervisors.
Production side.
Production side.
Not studio. Not working not, for not, a not, VFX
not,
studio.
Not vendor, although there is crossover. You know, you have like Paul Franklin. You have,
right.
You know, Pablo and yep. Dennis Muren. And, you know, there. So if you can, you know, you look at a movie like Avatar or Gravity, mm-hmm. or there are maybe 25, 30 people that can shepherd a show like that through,
mm-hmm.
and actually have it be what it needs to be in order to tell the story. Like, there's a very small group of people who can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they have leverage.
Okay.
Right? And the other thing is the production companies are in California.
Sure.
They're for the studios, and therefore they're governed by California labor law.
Okay.
Okay. So if you unionized them.
Okay.
And they formed a code of conduct that any vendor, regardless of where they were in the world, had to follow in order to work on a show that was unionized, you'd immediately approve labor conditions everywhere, regardless of local law.
Right.
Right. So if you said, okay, we're going to unionize. So let's theoretical. You have this VFX supervisor union. So you have
it's like a guild or
a
like,
guild. Yeah. You know, it would be IOTSI, you know, 924 or whatever.
Okay. I don't,
you know, so you have that. Once the show goes union, every department has to go union, right? You can't just hire a union actor and go, yeah, well, screw you, camera department.
Yeah. But they see the problem is that VFX is not part of the show. It's a vendor.
No, they hire vendors, but the VFX supervisor works for the production.
Yes.
Right. So he is hired by the production company here in LA,
mm-hmm.
if it's usually a studio film,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you're hiring like, oh yeah, we're making this movie and we're going to hire Tom Hanks to be in the movie and VFX. Okay. So you have Bob the VFX, I don't want to name any particular person, so right. I'll just call him Bob the VFX supervisor. He's in this theoretical guild. So he goes, okay, well, we can only hire this company,
right.
because they're the only ones who are abiding by our code of conduct.
Okay.
And that code of conduct would be exactly what you said. After 40 hours, time and a half.
Mm-hmm.
After 60 hours, double time. Minimum 12-hour turnaround.
Right.
You know.
So does that work on the actor side? Is that working right now?
Yes, it is.
So you want to mirror what's happening on the actor side?
Yeah. I mean, you. If you there's And the rather genius of this, if I may, I mean, that's rather self-congratulatory, but I don't mean to be. But the thing is that means that no matter where that vendor is in the world,
right,
they're still guided by that. And the other thing that would be part of this is that you would have a normalization. Part of it would be, you know, every 3 months there would be a foreign exchange rebalancing, and you could set minimums. Like a match mover makes $20 US, $23.60 Canadian, £14.95 pounds per hour, €16 an hour. So you'd have a minimum wage every, you know, in every country that you can, you know, you can always negotiate. There's no, that's a floor.
Studios would fight that so hard.
Oh God, because here's where the real power
lies.
We're
the largest group of people.
Oh, it's better than that, right? It's better than that because your three biggest, most powerful unions,
yeah,
kind of are SAG-AFTRA,
mm-hmm,
Directors Guild,
mm-hmm,
who've only gone on strike once in their entire existence for,
the Writers Guild, right?
I think about 12 seconds, and the Writers Guild.
Right.
Here's the thing about all three of those, right? The Writers Guild, the went on strike last in 2007,
mm-hmm,
okay? And suddenly we had a bunch of movies about a year later that were not so good,
right,
because they just, any script that was in process, they just shot it as is, right?
Right.
But if a script is really bad, like it's just in no shape that we shot, the studio just goes, you know what? We're not going to shoot that. Like we'll delay it till the strike is over, and then we can do some more rewrites and whatever. Same thing with an actor strike, because they're, you know, if you're contracted to finish a movie, you're contracted to finish a movie. If the guild, this theoretical VFX guild, we're at the end of the process, you got them by the balls, right? If you can get it so that your contract, this contract, which is usually done on a 3-year cycle, is expiring around March or so, say,
mm-hmm,
all of a sudden, if your VFX has 2.5 months left till it's going to be finished and your movie's finished and they are about to go on strike, well, you've your whole marketing plan in, you've made $25 million in ad buys,
yeah,
that have already started airing.
Right.
You can't change the release date of your movie.
Right.
It needs to get done.
Right.
And here's the thing is with VFX taking over so much of the work, you know, we would suddenly become the best ally the actors have,
mm-hmm,
the directors have, the writers have. You know, we need to stop seeing, like, every time I see animators and the VFX community as a whole attacking Andy Serkis, I'm just like, you idiots. He can, like, same thing with the mocap people.
Well, Andy Serkis, they're doing it because Andy Serkis seems to be basically belittling the work that's being done.
I don't think he's belittling.
But that's the way the tone
it's perceived. It's perceived, right? But, like, if you've ever worked with Andy and watched him act, there's this whole thing, I have a theory about performance, and this is like having worked in motion capture for 10 years. Mm-hmm. There's two different ways of looking at a performance. A lot of people look at it as, like, here's the exterior actions that are being done by the person.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, oh, he's reaching for the cup, okay? Mm-hmm. And so, okay, his hand is over here, but the cup is over here, so we need to adjust his hand,
mm-hmm,
right? But acting is an internal thing, mm-hmm, right? It's the external, like what a character is doing, what a physical character is doing,
mm-hmm,
is the external expression of the internal choices that character has made.
Sure.
So when you have all of the acting decisions made by a performer live on stage, that's the performer. Like no one's looking at True Lies and thinking that when, you know, there's a couple shots in that movie where you're like, that's not Arnold. Like, you know, it's a stuntman running down the snowy hill.
Right.
You know, or you know.
No, I get it because, okay, so let's use the Andy Serkis argument because it's a good one to talk about. Obviously, you were involved in some of those, that type of thing. But the argument is that Andy creates a performance and he said that it's digital makeup. That was the words he used instead of saying it's animation, right? And then the animators get really upset because they're like, well, we took his data and we had to make a lot of adjustments to make it work. That's not necessarily a limitation of what Andy did because Andy is performing.
Right.
And you feel, so a good animator can look at his performance, take on the limitations of what the capture system was or whatever is going on, and bring back the same emotion that was given by Andy back into the performance. And therefore, it's true to Andy's performance.
And where we get into this gray area.
The problem is that he's not acknowledging the actors. I mean, the animators.
Right? I completely agree, but I think there's a kind of...
There needs to be a mutual respect.
Believe it, I have met Andy multiple times. I've worked with Andy. He has the utmost respect for the people who do it. What I think a lot of people are doing are taking the shorthand that he is saying to a generic entertainment press.
I understand.
In order to make... You have to understand, just like I bet you, anyone in our industry, try explaining what you do to your grandma. She's not going to get it at all.
No, I understand that. I absolutely understand that. But at the same time, it's you know, a lot of people say it's like he's just trying to do that to basically say that the CG is doing way less than you think it is. All of that, it's my performance, and therefore he's vouching to get a Oscar nomination of some kind. That's the perceived idea that he's trying to do. What I would love it, my ideal world. Okay, it's never going to happen, but my ideal world is Andy gets nominated for an Oscar for a performance, and that is given to two people. It's the first time an acting award goes to two people. It'll never happen. But the point is that performance is happening by two people. Now, you can say this all the time, right? An editor can make or break an actor.
Yeah.
And a director can make or break an actor.
Yeah, it absolutely can. Like, the gray area that we get into, though, is when directors and VFX supervisors and whoever start to manipulate the performance beyond what the actor did because they've changed their mind.
Sure.
Okay? And it's a lot easier with a fully CG character than it is with a 2D plate.
Right.
But, you know, where we're going to get into an issue, and this is like kind of where you're going to see, I think, going forward in the next few years, you're going to see in the SAG-AFTRA contract that we're not going to be allowed to manipulate the performance.
Mm.
You know, that the actor is going to have final say-so over what can be done to them.
Yeah.
You know, because you can go in, you know, we've gone from, oh, well, let's get rid of that zit. Mm. You know, we can get rid of that zit. Like, oh, you know what? I think his abs could look a little bit better. Let's take care of that. Like, ooh, wow, that close-up really does not make that actress look as hot as we want her to. So
you have no idea how close that is to me.
Yeah. And then it gets into, hey, you know what? Let's have him smile there as that really awful thing is happening. And, you know, right now Tom Cruise can go, yeah, I don't want to do that. And because he has like that, my character would never do that. And he has control over that character's performance. And this kind of butts up against the whole kind of French auteur theory of who the author of the film is.
Well, I'll tell you that I have on very good authority that a lot of those, this person needs to look a little bit better. This needs to, that is actually being driven by the actors themselves.
Yeah.
And those actors are, and you're saying like, oh, I can't imagine how vain these people are. Not true. And I'll tell you why that's not true. They're doing it out of fear of the people that read Us Weekly and read all those magazines. If there's some little thing wrong with them, they get torn apart. So they are doing it just to eliminate the conversation.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. Like, I mean,
it's so sad. But we are putting that pressure on those actors.
It's happened before CG where actresses would be like, oh no, I can only be shot from this side.
Right.
You know, or they
And they're not doing it because they're vain. They're doing it because they don't want to be
lambasted. Yeah.
And it's so, because we lambast them.
I totally get that, but there's the what an actor can approve. Like, you know, actors have worn makeup since the beginning in order to make themselves look better. So I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with, you know, digitally removing zits or bags under the eyes or crow's feet or whatever that might be. What I'm saying is that the authorship, we're getting to the point where facial digital doubles are getting to the point where we could create a performance that the act that looks exactly like the actor.
It says something different.
That is not under that actor's control.
Right.
And that will start to become an issue for the
actors. We're already
actors.
Doing that with dead actors now.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, and that's something obviously a lot of people have ethical issues with, it, myself included. And listen, you're talking to the guy who started the, you know, the Wiki Human Project, Digital Human League. And my point of doing this is I want to move, honestly, I want to move that technology away from that. I want to make the importance of what digital humans are something other than bringing dead people back to life.
Well, I believe it or not, I actually think that the dead people back to life is going to become where a lot of the money for that is coming from.
Obviously, it is.
I know of one A-list actor who he went in to get his digital double scan made for a movie. And then he was like, hey, how much would it cost for me to do this for myself? And he had another set of data created for himself.
Right.
Because he was very far thinking and he knows that in 25 years, he will be able to play himself
as a younger person
because he has that data set. Just like right now where they have like...
But I also know actors, you know, I think Robin Williams has it in his contract that he can never be brought back to life digitally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of... These are things that are happening.
It's things that are happening. And like this is kind of the big hang up right now for virtual production because right now if you're going to shoot a movie, right? And you're like, okay, well, we need to build a kitchen. So let's build a kitchen. We need to get plates. We need to get, you know, a teapot and stove and everything like that. You go off to a prop shop and you rent it for 2 days.
Right.
And it costs you $50 to rent a teapot.
Yeah.
Right now you're like, oh, shit, we have to have a modeler work for 2 days modeling, texturing, and look deving this teapot that we can never use again. Right. Or actors, like you have the same generic awful puppet. So, you know, it's like I want virtual production to get to a point where you have like a marketplace where, you know, you're not getting a Alembic or an OBJ, but there's just like some kind of protected little file that you're like, okay, we need to rent a Maserati model for the next 72 hours.
We should just look to the Arcfest community because that's out there.
Yeah.
I mean, Evermotion, it's like it's one of the biggest things around. Basically, one of the biggest reasons that Arcfest is looking so good now, if you really look at a lot of the Arcfest stuff, it's like, wow, that looks beautiful. All that person really did was make four walls, a window, and then filled it with crap that they bought from Evermotion.
Yeah.
Okay? And so it's set dressing.
well, what I'm talking about is not buying. Because the problem is that then you buy it.
But buying is nothing. The Maserati you buy online is going to cost you like $55.
Right. But but if you – that's then the property of that production.
Okay.
Not of – then you get into the whole vendor thing and everything like that. What I'm saying is – if you can rent it, right? Or if you can go and you have a library of humans, right? Where you can do your previs and you go, okay, here's what the sequence would look like with Channing Tatum. Here's like what it would look like with Chris Hemsworth. Here's what it would look like with Tom Cruise.
I see what you're saying.
Here's like what, and then you can just do almost like screen testing of, wow, that, you know what? Channing Tatum and Mila Kunis really do look good together. Let's put them at the top of our list in terms of who we want, you know? Where you could license out, where you could call up that agent, that actor's agent.
I think that's a little crazy idea, Dave.
Well, I'm a little.
I don't know if actors would like that. It's like, yeah, you're just going to cast me before I'm even there.
But it's not about casting it. It's about how much would an actor love, right? Where if you're going in, because like there's a huge future coming up in PitchViz, right?
PitchViz.
You know, and which for anyone listening who doesn't know, that's when you, it's previz, but you're making previz before you're even like anywhere close to being greenlit to make the movie.
You do tests, but the tests are actually kind of mini shorts.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, like Westball did it with Ruin.
And he talked about it here. And then obviously Roy Robinson did it with his Leviathan.
Leviathan and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I would love where, you know, you can go and you can do like a little quick grab, you know, your SAG-AFTRA day player who goes.
So you're talking about even motion capture libraries and everything else?
Motion capture libraries, but also just like where you have a volume that you can go and you can rent and you can go in and just, you know, you can go and rent a studio like LA everywhere. You just pay like $500. You get a stage with green screen or whatever. But, you know, if you had a motion capture volume that you could just go in and it was all set up for virtual production in terms of like, okay, let's go in. You grab your SAG-AFTRA actor, and they go and they do their scene, and you know they get paid their $350 for the day. I think that's what it is now. I'm not sure. Don't quote me. And then you go, okay, let's take that data, and now let's you know, call up you know, CAA and go, hey, we're thinking about casting this actor. You know, for the role, we know he's interested in the script, but we, you know, we couldn't get him for the 4 days of a test shoot because he's often, you know, Wellington shooting some, you know, movie where he's grown a beard and his hair is down to, you know, so can we get his data file?
Right.
And they said that his, you know, his agents are in charge of that data package.
Gotcha.
And that's, you know, I can totally see that as being, you know, they have this asset that works for them and that can be used by the community. But you can also get, like, I don't understand why every single actor who has, like, you know, yeah, you're going in to get your headshots. Why don't you get a little, you know, light stage type thing? And that way you can go and, you know, license that out because I'm sick of seeing the same generic humans.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine. Who's actually a really big, you know, pretty well known actor, character actor. And I was talking to him, and I was talking about stuff we were doing on digital. And he was like, "Huh? So, scanning? Can I get that then?" It's like, "Yeah. I know what you mean." Well, listen, we're running a bit long.
Oh,
but,
God, yeah.
Is there anything else you want to talk about? Is you're in LA now? You're looking for work?
Yeah,
you're
open to gigs. I'm working on this little independent movie right now.
Nice.
That it's a little bit up in the air right now because the majority of the filming, and I'm specifically saying the filming rather than the shooting.
Because it's on film?
No. No, because it's in Paris.
Ah.
So, you know.
Cinema.
Yeah. Well, no, but right now if you say we're shooting in Paris, it has a whole other connotation.
Oh, yeah, I gotcha.
And, you know, Paris is my favorite city in the world. I'm trying to be very sensitive. But that whole situation has possibly put a little bit of a damper on what might be going on in that movie. And we're also, like, the plan is also to shoot for 12 days here in L.A.
Okay.
And that's my involvement, is the L.A. shoot.
Gotcha.
But so I'm waiting on that. But, you know, I'm open to work. So if anyone has any VFX work that's L.A. local, please let me know.
Yeah. Well, as you know, we were talking about it earlier. It's like a lot of people, actually some of the really big smart VFX people that are in LA that didn't want to move to London or Vancouver. Majority of them left the industry, right?
Yeah, and they have.
So they're all going to other areas because there's other work. But there is, as you said, there's actually some really great TV work that's being done here. And I think TV is sort of at its new golden age right now.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful, beautiful work.
Absolutely is, you know. It's a shame that the Emmy for Best Visual Effects isn't on the broadcast so that they can get it played off.
Right.
yeah. Life of Pi style.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway. All right, David. I appreciate you being
on. Hey, thanks for having me.
And I'm sure we'll have you again. Now that you're local, we'll definitely get to hang out much more.
Yeah.
Since like I said, it's...
And I managed to go the entire podcast, I think, without swearing too badly.
No, I don't. I think I actually said more curse words than most people.
Yeah, I was worried because 6 years in London and that C-bomb comes out like that.
All right, guys. Thanks. We're going to let the last bucket drop and see you next time. Bye, guys.
He's lying. There's no bucket.